Hi, welcome to the first inaugural premiere number one episode of Conversations for Deeper Context. I'm Jeremy Myers. In this series, I'll be talking to people I like and respect about what drives them, especially around curiosity. This first episode is with my friend Megan Elizabeth Morris from ideaschema.org. I met Megan on Seth Godin's tribes.com community site, what seems like forever ago, and I was struck by her infectious enthusiasm for basically everything. Seriously, you'll see. Anyway, I love her writing, and she has a lot to say, and we have a lot to say together, so, you know, hold on to your hats or your seats or whatever it is you hold on to. Here's our deeper context conversation. Enjoy.
All right, well, I'm hitting record, so we're on.
Okay.
So that's fine. Some of the things that I wanted to talk about with you I think curiosity is something that comes up for me a lot, and I think maybe if even though you don't specifically write about it, that there's a lot of it in what you do put out there.
Yeah.
In like, hey, what's this like? And that's sort of like the stuff that comes up before the brain starts spinning and being able to focus on that and not so much on the but what if it doesn't work out kind of thing.
That's interesting because that's kind of what I've been writing about just the past few days because I sent you some of the stuff that's going up on the blog next week.
Totally, which is awesome.
And there's a lot of the basis of that stuff that is curiosity. And I imagine by the time this goes up on the internet, that stuff will already be out there.
You can certainly make it happen that way.
Yeah, that's easy enough. the curiosity for me taps into play and humor and just sort of fundamental. Let me find the basis for you. You totally that whole idea about editing and letting us get our footing before you edit stuff out and stuff like that. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
that was a really good idea. I can see that now. Curiosity for me is one of these fundamentally human things. And I think it's fundamental to a lot of other things too. So I obviously we see curiosity in animals. Curiosity seems to be something that lets us learn. That it is a thing that lets us learn, that lets us do things, that lets us have better lives. Curiosity is the root of trying to eat a plant with spikes on it and finding out that that's not such a great idea and then maybe not doing that anymore. It's also the root of wondering what would happen if I tried this thing and then finding out that this thing turns out to improve the quality of my life in dramatic ways. And without curiosity, you can't really get to those things. And so I've been doing a lot of work in thinking about what is really natural, either to human beings or to anything in existence, and trying to run my life and my work on that basis, and curiosity is part of it.
And there's so many additional layers on top of curiosity and any of those sort of core things that all those, I mean, we were just talking about all the shoulds of the world, and they really do, like, take us away from, hey, wouldn't it be interesting if? And I think, like, curiosity is also, it's basically a key connecting force, right? Mm-hmm. That's what connects us to other people and to other experiences, and without it, we're just kind of, you know, I feel like people who are depressed or whatever, that's the big part of that is a loss of their connection to their own curiosity.
Yes, that's really interesting. And another thing about curiosity is that we could look at curiosity as a signaling mechanism.
Oh, absolutely.
If we believe in fate, and I don't know that I do, but let's just say for the moment, if we believe in fate, curiosity could certainly function as a signaling mechanism to lead you to the next place for you.
Sure. And or if we don't, information about like it not being the next place.
Right. And also just if you think about Alan Watts has this whole thing about plants and animals and the things in the universe, they don't try. to grow. They don't, it's the whole relaxed state of proactive engagement again. They don't work hard to grow. They don't work hard to improve their careers and, you know, to have better jobs for the rest of their life. They just grow. That's what they do. And I think that human beings are capable of that kind of Zen level of growth in the same way. And curiosity seems like that is a key to it. What are you curious about? Well, that's sort of a tiny expression of desire. And why not simply follow that to see where it goes? That's what everything else does. Humans, as far as we know, are the only ones who agonize over it.
Yeah. And then why do you think that people don't follow their curiosity as much as seems to be useful? Well, I mean, all right. So my friend Mindy talks a lot about always choosing the counterintuitive option. Mm-hmm. Maybe our intuition doesn't, or whatever we consider to be our intuition, that part of our mind, mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily serve our own best interest. Mm-hmm. And I think that for a lot of people and for in the world, they're not necessarily, you know, curiosity can be in direct conflict to what we think of as common sense. I think so. There's a lot of external pushback against the, I mean, what I would consider the ideal, and something that I struggle with sometimes, is the like, hey, it might be interesting if I gave this a shot, and if it doesn't work out, then I'll try something else. Mm-hmm. There's so much, I think, out there that's like, you got to be good at it or don't even bother, or, you know, who do you think you are, or
sure.
Shame, or, you know, any
of
that stuff.
I don't think, and this is obviously just my opinion, but sure. But I don't think that those things are really our intuition or our common sense. I think that in my experience, what I used to think was my intuition or my common sense was actually stuff that was really tapped into what other people wanted me to do. Yeah. And when I started digging down through layers of self-awareness, and it will be up on the blog, I imagine, by the time people see this, that self-awareness is the root of all of these wonderful, wonderful changes in my life. When I started to focus there, I started to be able to peel away these layers of things that I thought were me, but they weren't me. They were, in the words of Robert Anton Wilson, and Timothy Leary have this thing called the Eight Circuit Model of Consciousness, which you can read about in a book called Prometheus Rising. And it's fascinating because it talks about things like the oral biosurvival circuit that is the thing that makes a baby latch on to its caregiver and consider that person the source of its survival. And I started to see the ways in which my oral biosurvival circuit was still functioning quite loudly in the rest of my life, making me think that all of these things were essential to my survival, when in fact they no longer were. It just didn't know. It didn't understand because its key function is to make sure that I survive from being a helpless baby. And now that I'm an adult, I can listen to that voice, but not necessarily, you know, always be at its bidding. And realizing that has allowed me to see a lot more clearly what my curiosity really is, what my wants really are, what I really want to do, rather than thinking that I want this, but I also want that, but I also want this other thing, but I also want this other thing. Most of those are usually things that I think I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, and I think it's not just from when we're children, you know, we evolutionarily, to make up a word, you know, we're programmed to be always be on the lookout for potential dangers and predators, and I like to say a lot of our fear is really about not wanting to get eaten by bears.
Sure.
So I think that's a lot of the core of, like, you know, we want to be safe, and here's what the world says we need to do to be safe, and
sure,
fine, but that doesn't get us, you know, at the end, a safe life
And we have these incredibly complicated systems that have evolved from just from human beings saying, well, you know, let's try and do this particular way. Maybe this will keep us safer. And then those systems evolve and they get more and more complicated. And of course, we have very complex governments now. We have very complex ways of growing food now. There are all of these systems that we have created. And I think that what has happened over the course of time maybe has to do with humans thinking that they need to control other humans in order to be safe and happy. And so much so that many of us have just completely bought into it. Many of us think that that's really the world as it exists, that's really reality, that we are under the control of someone, that the only power we have is when somebody says, okay, on this day, you can vote for this person or this person. Yeah. And I think it's so easy for us to just see that as our reality. But I watched The Matrix again last night.
I was just going
to
bring that up.
Oh, man, did it speak to me. I mean, I've seen it a lot of times, but I haven't seen it since my recent revelatory period of insanity. And it says a lot of those things.
Yeah, there really is. There's so much in that movie and that works at basically like every, you know, as much attention as you pay to it, that is what it will give back to you.
I agree.
So I guess like one of the things that I have learned in couples therapy actually is this hugely bizarre concept to a lot of us is that you can go into a relationship, be it a romantic relationship or any sort of relationship with yourself or with somebody else, and say, you know, we can make this whatever we want. You know what? It doesn't have to be what society tells us it needs to be. It doesn't have to be, you know, within the square or outside of the square in a way that people think is okay.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're self-aware and conscious and compassionate, you can make your relationship, you can make your life, you can make this moment sort of whatever you want.
Sure.
And that I think both is a profoundly freeing idea to internalize and also profoundly dangerous to the complex systems that we've created for ourselves in order to put people in a hierarchy. And
it's only dangerous as long as we think that our survival is threatened when those systems are threatened. And I think there, I mean, that mentality is out there.
Sure.
But I am seeing in my life and in the lives of people close to me, and in many, I've been sort of gathering evidence over time for things like this. And I keep seeing how when people are freed up, and when people come to understand themselves better and understand their little drives and their little twitches more clearly, I am not seeing that they go out and hurt other people. I am not seeing that they seek to take advantage of other people. I am seeing that people who are freed up emotionally and mentally and physically and societally, they just exist. They're not out to hurt somebody.
Sure.
But the hurting people, the things that we're all afraid of might happen when a system breaks down is usually, oh, well, crime will be rampant and people will do
widespread
anything
chaos
they want, and there will be, you know, stealing and rape and all of these things.
Cats and dogs living together.
Exactly. but I mean, yes, those things might happen, but I think that the reason that things like that happen, it is more often that there's a misunderstanding. Someone doesn't know how to get what they need. Someone feels like their ability to survive is threatened. Somebody feels like they don't know how to get connection in certain ways. And I'm starting to be of the opinion that we can't solve those problems simply by punishing them or by making them illegal and enforcing those laws. I think that there is a much simpler answer. I think if we simply are compassionate with one another and give each other space and patience and a certain amount of love and just say, you know, if there's something wrong, we can work on it. We can talk about it. Spread self-awareness, spread education. And I can't help but think that maybe a lot of those problems just won't be problems anymore. And that it's pretty idealistic, but it I haven't seen any evidence that specifically refutes it for me. And I'm very interested in seeing where that goes.
Yeah, I think it's kind of just yet another illusion, as we were talking about before. Like there's sort of our own personal bears, and then there's our community's bears, and then there's the country's bears.
Sure. And I don't think anybody set the bears loose on purpose.
No.
I don't really believe in evil people. I believe in people who just are under some kind of misunderstanding. And yes, sometimes people do things that we have to draw a line. We have to draw healthy boundaries in terms of what we are okay with, whether it actually does threaten somebody's survival or not. I mean, people have to interact with each other in those ways, and those things have to be negotiated in some way. But I think that there is a pretty wide misconception that the reason there are bad things in the world is because there's something bad about the people. And from books like, I think Sex at Dawn had stuff in this in it, and there were a couple of other books. Hobbes said something about the life of human beings being nasty and brutish and short before civilization, and how that might have simply been a misconception.
And that certainly feeds into our story about it, that, like, you know, the only thing keeping us all from destroying each other is rules.
Sure. And that kind of factors in when you start talking about things like religion and morality too. There's this conception that without the rules, without some sort of agreed upon guidelines, that we would all just run amok. Yep. Maybe we would run amok. You know what? Running amok sounds like quite a lot of fun to me.
Yes.
But my running amok has nothing to do with hurting other people. If I'm running amok, and I'm certainly seeing this in my life, I wrote about my own brand of motivation. When I get right down to the root of what I really want to do, if I'm running amok, I'm probably trying to make other people's lives better because it's fun, because it's enjoyable to help one another, because there is increased connection and meaning in helping one another. And what are humans if not meaning-making machines?
Sure. So I lived in New York for most of my life until a year ago. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, like coming to the South and living in a Southern city, there's an interesting, like, there is both a lot of pleasantness in a way that you just kind of don't see in, well, New York specifically, but probably more like generally fast-paced cities.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely a you know, say hi to people on the street and stuff. But there's also a wider sense of us and them. I mean, I guess that might be specific to Atlanta or something. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely, to sort of connect to what you were saying, the, like, we're good people and we have to keep the bad people away. And there's such a sort of an essentialism to it, and I don't think I'd be reaching to say that there's some racial stuff around that. When you hear people talk about it, there's definitely, I mean, I don't know, I pay attention a lot to people's body language and how they say things, maybe even more than just what they're saying.
Sure.
And there's definitely, like, a tightness and a self-definition there that's, you know, and pride, maybe, I'm protecting my family against the bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me a little uncomfortable, because in New York, there's no way to avoid dealing with a whole lot of different kinds of people, because mm-hmm. there's just so many people and everyone's smushed together.
Billions of them.
Yeah, and you can't walk down the street without hearing a bunch of different languages and people who look all kinds of different mm-hmm. and stuff. So I think, I mean, maybe I was spoiled in that sense, and I think that's sort of like a, even though I'm not a huge fan of New York anymore, I think that a big good part of that place is that there's a whole bunch of different people all rubbing up against each other. And that, I think, sort of will dissolve that element of what we make up for ourselves.
Sure. And I think that when it comes down to it, and of course, I grew up in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and I still experienced a lot of the us versus them mentality, so much so that I thought that was just a fundamental realistic viewpoint. It seems to me that stuff like that comes from a place where if you grow up in a certain environment, if you grow up with people talking about the thems, then you don't necessarily know that the situation might be different until you are put in that situation.
We don't exist in a vacuum, for sure. and context is so important. Even, I mean, it's interesting to think about that in terms of the curiosity and, you know, what we think we would be like with no rules and stuff, because, you know, at this point, the species has gotten way beyond, I think, whatever expectations that the world had for it in terms of the different kinds of experiences that and the different surroundings. I mean, I have this thing where I think humanity was not meant to scale as big as it has. Because if you look at, like, Dunbar's number and things like that, you know, after a certain point, systems are inefficient and people get lost, you know.
Well, what is your, what is lost. Your meant to, for, where does that come from? You said in some ways something like maybe humans aren't meant to scale. Yeah, where does that come from?
I just think, like, looking at how groups of people interact with each other beyond a certain size, the tools that we use to organize and ensure the to the benefit of everyone start to break down.
There is certainly an argument that I think could be made that the only reason that human beings are so that we have grown so fast has been because we have thought things with our human brains and created systems that didn't already exist that allowed us to do so in many ways at the expense of the nature around us. And that's really interesting to me because that mechanism is definitely natural. I mean, we came by this honestly. We came by our semantic circuits honestly. This thing that may or may not separate us from every other creature on the planet, we don't really know. Yep. This ability to think about ourselves and to come up with all of these ideas and to imagine in these ways and then create systems that create systems that create systems. I mean, what is it if not natural? And then, of course, you start to think, well, do we then exercise control over that impulse or not? It's a very interesting question.
Yeah, and also at a certain point, do the systems no longer serve us? And what do we do when we have scaled to a point where these systems are not nimble enough to be adjusted, but we sort of find ourselves stuck in things that we didn't foresee? I mean, even going back to, like, the Constitution and, like, things like the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. And I have no issue with people who want to own guns for sport or whatever. Mm-hmm. But at the time, the Second Amendment was written in a way that served the technology and the needs and the fact that we had just gotten out of a big war and, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, although it did serve us and I'm certainly not advocating for any huge change in the Constitution, at what point are we able to, at any scale, look at our systems and our assumptions and what codes we live by and say, well, maybe this is not serving us anymore? And not necessarily that thing in particular, that's just something that came up in my brain.
Yeah, I think that's really the best and most fundamental question is, are we happier? Yeah. Are we healthier? And I think the answer, at least in my spheres, at least in my, you know, American spheres, is no, we're not. We're not happier. We're not healthier. We have a whole host of crazy problems that we don't really know the solutions to. And there is science that suggests that they may not have been a problem a while back before certain systems were introduced. And that may be right and that may be wrong, but we can get very complacent because we have created these comfortable lives for ourselves because there's all these resources flowing around and we all get to have things like decent soft beds and, you know, we're not sleeping on rocks most of the time. There are people out there sleeping on rocks, sadly, but I'm not. Yeah. And the people I know aren't. And the reason for that is that we live in a wealthy society, but it's wealthy in terms of artificial money and resources. It's not really wealthy in terms of connection and happiness quotient and stuff like that. And we have to remember that we made these systems. These systems are our systems. If we're choosing to live in a system under a certain kind of politics or in a certain kind of culture, we are choosing to live in that place with those restrictions. And if we examine them and find they do not serve us, we can make a different choice. And sometimes that might be scary. Sometimes it might mean revolution. Sometimes you might be afraid that the police are going to come after you. And all of those things are totally possible. Those things absolutely do happen to people. But unless we decide to choose something else, we'd better get really used to living with whatever restrictions somebody else puts on us, because that's what our lives are going to be if we're not willing to choose something else.
And I think they have been. I mean, in a grand sense, and I think the growing discomfort with what the situations we put on ourselves are mm-hmm. pretty directly connected to the wider visibility of information and personal experience sure. because of the interwebs.
Well, you can, I mean, we can take it down to money. For instance, I've been reading Sacred Economics by Charles Eisenstein, and people are really sick of hearing about it, but I'm going to talk about it some more.
I'm happy to listen, and I want to do a whole other thing about that specifically. So let's
awesome.
Let's do it.
I shoot myself down too quickly. If you look at the money system, I did not realize before I started reading that book and checking some of the information with people I knew who understood economics better than I did, I did not know how clearly money might be at the root of some of the really difficult stuff going on in the world. And what Charles Eisenstein says is that he believes that what happened was not intentional, was not somebody really greedy out to game the system. And, you know, that might be true or it might not. That the money system, in terms of being an interest-based system, happened to develop in a way that actually kind of shot us in both feet. And we didn't realize why that was happening, but we kept trying to solve it, but we were solving it from the more complicated direction instead of the more simple direction.
I think that, just to that point specifically, my theory has always been anytime you mm-hmm. put a number next to something,
sure.
you will be comparing yourself. And that, you know, that certainly is the big number, seems to, in the society measure.
Well, sure, because we had this opportunity to make transactions and exchanges and things in a much more granular way than we were able to before. And that is certainly exciting on a lot of levels. It gives us a lot of freedom to do a lot of things that we can't do without some kind of money. And maybe we didn't realize that the kind of money we put together had these unintentional consequences in terms of there is a lot of incentive for people to stockpile the money. There is a lot of understanding, or I would say misunderstanding, in the world that money equals security. And I am seeing now that it doesn't.
Yeah.
That I've been taught my whole life that if I have enough money, I will be safe. And I am seeing very clearly now that simply is not true. If I have enough connection in my life, that is the closest approximation to really being safe as I can even think of.
Yeah, and that leads to opportunities
sure. I mean, other
to
than
do
being
things
dead,
that may
I
bring
guess
in more
dead
resources.
Dead is about as safe as you can get because you're there and
well.
That's it. But in terms of being a living human being,
yeah.
The more connection I have in my life, the more I have a tribe, the more we take care of each other, the more we help each other, the more we can leverage our resources with each other, the more likely we are to thrive. And isn't my understanding is that that's how human beings came to thrive at all, ever. And so, yes, that seems so fundamental to me.
That is the point.
And so the idea that our survival is now attached in public perception to how many symbols we have in a computer, how many green paper tickets we have, in the words of Robert Anton Wilson, that it's just a misunderstanding. And you don't, you know, even people with lots of money, that I don't know that they get happier. I think maybe they get more stressed out.
No, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that, you know, the suicide rate of lottery winners is
wow.
way higher than the general population. There's any number of studies that show that beyond a certain number of certain salary number or income, yearly income number, happiness based on that sort of plateaus. And I think it's based on, you know, can you get your basic needs met and do you have a little extra for,
well, for
you know,
fun,
toys?
Because human beings like to play.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you don't necessarily need things that you need to give paper tickets for, but there seems to be a threshold.
Right, right.
After
I think that the more we base our actions on our own individual happiness, as selfish as it sounds, I mean, just like the blog post, I think it went up today, right? The one that I read. The blog post that you wrote about selfishness and self-compassion was really clear in wonderful ways to me. I really, really appreciated it because we have this, it's this anathema thing to be selfish. But as you said, unless we are taking care of ourselves, taking care of other people doesn't really work. And if we start to base all our actions on what would really actually make ourselves happy, we might discover that we have plenty of fuel to help each other after that point. But how will we know unless we try? Yeah. And right now, our society, it, as far as I can see, is basing its idea of success on how much money everybody has. And there are a lot of angry people out there, and it is not unreasonable for them to be angry. And I think instead of being angry at other people, perhaps we can turn that energy into something that helps us learn more about ourselves and solve the problems from the root of the problem instead of trying to put Band-Aids on the symptoms and not knowing why we're not getting anywhere.
Somebody's been reading Lessig,
too. Oh, is
too.
It really? Because I used to read...
That's his big...
I read a bunch of his stuff a while back, and I have more of it on my reading list, and he is one of my... I have so much respect for that man, and I've been wanting to read more of his stuff, and that's really awesome, because I haven't read that stuff that you're talking about.
Him and the EFF are the two charities that I donate regularly to.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, his whole thing is that there's a quote that I'm not going to be able to pull up in time, but about there's like 30 people hacking away at the branches of corruption while to every one that strikes at the root.
Sure, sure.
So that's where he gets root strikers from. So, his whole thing is to get private money out of elections and campaigning in order to ensure that the people being served are not the people who are not the 0.05% of people who spend millions and millions of dollars, you know, who move those numbers into a column and therefore
and Charles Eisenstein also talks about in Sacred Economics, he talks about how the interest-based money system encourages money to be stockpiled and sit in one place for long periods of time because then it will gather interest. But what he is and there are ways in which I think people have conceived that would be good for everybody too. But what Eisenstein says is that if we change the system in a variety of ways, one of the things that could happen is that money would by default have an incentive to flow. Money would have it would become less less valuable the longer it sat in the same place. And that's a really interesting idea when you see not only that a small number of people are stockpiling the largest amounts of money, but also that so many of us are feeling like in order to get ahead, in order to have good lives, in order to be worthy of love, in order to be successful and to have respect in the eyes of our peers, we have to stockpile money too. And so there is this desperation of why haven't I stockpiled enough money? And it goes nowhere, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and there's no end to it. It reminds me of when Louis C.K. put his stand-up special on the internet for $5 and made $1 million. I think AV Club or somebody interviewed him about it and like what he did with the money. And he gave a huge chunk of it to charity. He paid people on his staff who he wasn't able to pay well on his show. He gave them like a whole huge chunk of change. And his reasoning was... He doesn't like to let money pool up around him, and when it does, he needs to. Sure. He feels the need to get to push it away because it gets in the way. I mean, I think it kind of goes back to the bears thing. I think you know there's the animal part of our brain that thinks if I have enough in this column, the bears won't get me. And it's
Sure.
Bears
sure.
Get bear, you in the end no matter
might
what.
Get us no matter what, but why
it's
why spend all of our time worrying about it? Make some reasonable decisions about what keeps you happier, what keeps you a little safer, what makes your life, you know, make sense, and then just let it go. Seems to make a lot more sense. And another thing that Eisenstein talks about is the whole full-time jobs thing. You said something to me about there being a potential ideal world out there where nobody had to hold down a full-time job. And when I got to that part of Sacred Economics, I was like, I sort of gaped at the page for a minute. I was like, did he really just say that? Oh my God, this is exciting. Because I have had that too, but I kind of thought that it was this flimsy little dream that could never happen. And then I'm reading what he's talking about, and what he's saying is because we have to have a growing economy in order to deal with the problems of interest-based money systems, in order to keep it growing, we're creating all of these jobs where we're basically people go to work for 40 hours a week and they throw rocks over a fence, and then they run around to the other side of the fence and they throw the rocks back over, and that's their job. And no wonder so many people are so out of touch with the meaning in their lives. No wonder we don't know what makes us happy, because we have unintentionally brainwashed ourselves into thinking that what's supposed to make us happy is throwing rocks over the fence and accumulating more paper tickets, and it doesn't make any sense. It's dogma. It's just more dogma.
Yeah, 70% of people report being disengaged and dissatisfied with their jobs, and you know, I'm sure that number's low because of the paper tickets, and because this is the world that is presented to us. I kind of wanted to go back a little bit to, we were talking about comfort and complacency, and I wonder, not to make this like a Q&A thing, but I wonder what you feel about the relationship between comfort and complacency and curiosity. Because I'm thinking, to me, just right off the bat, it feels like they're very sort of on very different sides of the spectrum.
The first thing that comes up for me is that when we are comfortable, we might still be able to, we might still have the urge towards curiosity. And depending on what that comfort is exactly, we might be able to follow the curiosity. So what I think many of us have conceived of is this idea that if we have enough money, we will have enough comfort, we will have enough time, we can follow our curiosity wherever it leads us. And so that plays into our fundamental drive towards curiosity, our fundamental drive to simply do what we want to do. But what has come with a lot of our comfort in a first world problems sense is that we think that the only way we can have certain kinds of comfort, and that might be true, but it might not be true, is to follow the rules in the system. And the rules in the system say, well, you have to work a lot in order to make enough money to do such a thing, or you have
to be okay when you die.
Right.
When you're old.
Or you have to be really lucky. And, you know, without increasing the connection in our lives, that getting old and not having any money thing means a whole different thing, because who's going to take care of you? Who are you going to take care of if you do not have connections in your life? If instead
that's a reason to stay in a relationship.
You know, and but what happens is that we think that in order to maintain our comfort and thereby be able to indulge our curiosity, that we have to follow the rules. And we believe that so staunchly that we become complacent, and we think that the rules are the most important thing. But then what happens is that the system of rules that we're being told to follow is so out there and ridiculous in terms of what is natural to life and to human beings, that we end up following the rules and then being really confused as to why we don't have the comfort that we think we should have yet. Why don't we have the security that we're supposed to have? And why haven't we been able to indulge our curiosity? Because in fact, that was the point in the beginning. And what I am seeing in my life in concrete ways, and I'm trying not to be preachy about it, but I am failing in lots of cases.
It's enthusiasm. That's fine.
In my life, what I'm seeing is that if I remove the following the rules conundrum, if I say to myself, you know what, I don't really need to follow the rules technically.
You can if you want, but you don't have to.
I can if I want. I don't have to. And what I see is that indulging my curiosity is leading me to more connection and more art and more meaning and more fun and more humor and more play. And those things are getting me resources that I need to be safe and secure. Those things are increasing the connection that I have in my life. And that is continuing to happen, and no one is more surprised than me. But it is, and it hasn't stopped. And people I love are also seeing it in our lives and in my life. And so I'm not the only one coming up with these crazy ideas and you know, fooling myself into thinking that they're real. This is really actually happening, and it is resulting in me building a theory that all of this dogma that we get from the government or from religions or from culture or whatever, every instance where one person is trying to tell another person what they have to do, I think is perhaps always wrong.
Yeah, I'm on board. I'm on board. I mean, I think anytime there's a should, there's a whole bunch of assumptions. Even on a very basic level, there's the person saying it has their own context for the world that may not match up at all with yours.
Sure. And I am also seeing that the more we seek self-awareness, the more we're willing to be incredibly painfully honest with ourselves and other people, the more we actually find out what makes us tick and what we need. And I think that the closer we get to that, the more we can just interact freely with other people and indulge in creativity and curiosity and make art and help each other. And you know what that is? That's business. That's marketing. That's, you know what, business is not about how many dollars you have in a bank account. Business is like my business, your business, monkey business. Business is about what we do for and with each other. That's all it ever was to begin with. Why else would anybody decide to be the person who makes these things for the tribe? Why would somebody be the hunter for the tribe? Why would somebody take care of the children? Because we do things for each other. That's it.
And we've really put the goalposts in a place that doesn't serve us.
Well, I think
it serves the system.
What, and I mean, I'm overhauling all of my business activities in this direction, and I'm gathering people who are willing to be my guinea pigs to see if it works for them too. And what I have been thinking about over the last few days has been the possibility that in the short time, human beings have had these additional brain functions. Because my understanding is that it has been a relatively short period of time over the course of all of this evolution that has happened, that it is a much shorter time where we have been civilized. It is a much shorter time that we have been building all of these systems. And if that is the case, is it possible that as human beings, we're awkward. We just don't know what to do with these complex brains. We have this ability to build these amazing systems, and yes, we've been using it to control each other, but maybe it's just because we haven't learned how to do something more natural with it. Maybe it's just because we don't fully understand how we can use all of the internal resources at our disposal. And the only reason that we've set the goal in a convoluted, strange place is because it seemed obvious at the time. I mean, teenagers make stupid mistakes sometimes, and then we learn from them and we do something different. And I think that's happening. A lot of what Charles Eisenstein says and things I've read in other books have suggested to me that we are all moving towards something that might be really wonderful, and it makes me sound like a hippie. It makes me sound like an idealist. I don't know if it's a bad thing or not. I kind of like hippies personally. It sounds crazy until you start living it, and I'm kind of living it in a lot of ways right now. And so I'm making an effort to not be flighty about it. I'm making an effort to really examine and be honest with myself about what's going on to avoid the usual pitfalls of, you know, seeing something that you want. But I haven't been able to refute it yet. And that makes me so incredibly optimistic about the future of the human race. If this is possible for me, what does that mean for everybody? It means something.
Yeah, I think it definitely does. And I've been, one of the things that I've thought for a while is that just to bring it out to sort of a macro level, the United States is in its awkward teenage rebellion phase,
mm-hmm.
where when you're 14 and 15, a lot of your brain development is around a sense of identity as distinct from the adults around you and being difficult and potentially and very emotional and very, you know, sort of based on impulse.
Sure.
So there, I think there, that we're sort of at the moment, and maybe as a planet too, but I can only speak for the limited amount of information that we get about other countries. We are definitely in a screw you, dad, I'm going to do what I want and punch you if you don't like it, because I'm the best kind of thing.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, you know, we got to grow up sometime.
I've seen that viewpoint in a few different places, and now I've seen it in enough places that now I'm conscious of it. And Eisenstein definitely talked about it, and I'm gonna have to really start noticing where else I see stuff like that come up, because there are people who believe that, that human development also applies in really interesting ways to the overall development of the human species.
Oh yeah. I love when things turn out to be fractal like that.
Meta, that's definitely where I'm coming from.
It's so great. Yeah. Actually, the tagline on my blog for a long time, and I think it might still be, is people and companies have the same problems on different scales.
Sure.
I have one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
We were going back and talking about the anger that people who are limited in resources or notice the injustice and the mm-hmm. ridiculousness, the fact that people get angry, and rightly so, because it's profoundly unfair. Mm-hmm. But I have written down on my notepad here, fight the rules versus ignore the rules. And I wonder what the difference you think it is, and how effective might one be over the other in affecting this change that we both seem to be down for.
I don't think we can say in any kind of broad encompassing way that one is more effective or better than the other. What I would say is, do you want to fight or do you want to do something else? I don't think that most of us are going to find our happiness in spending all of our time ignoring the rules and hoping we don't get caught. Or ignoring the rules and spending some time in jail. I mean, there are certainly things, there are absolutely the repercussions to any action we might choose to make. But I think there are a lot of people living their lives right now in a way that, you know, they give the rules a certain amount of respect just because, you know, the rules weren't made by people trying to screw with us. The rules were made by people really honestly trying to do something that would help human beings. And just because the system doesn't always work, it doesn't mean that it is a bad thing, but we can choose to live our lives in a different way without flaunting the rules, without saying, ha ha, so there. We can live our lives quietly. We can focus on things that make us happy without necessarily doing one or the other. And so then I think the only reason to fight the rules, and I think there are a lot of arguments for standing up and speaking out. There's stuff happening in Texas right now that is really major in terms of women's health and women's rights to their own bodies. I have so much respect for the people who are deciding to speak out. And I have thought a lot about doing a lot of that myself. And I think that it all just comes down to, what do you really want right now? What really fuels you right now? Because for some people, the answer is that they get a lot of really good connection and juice from standing up and from speaking out and from helping others in that way. And there are other people who get a lot of juice from kind of hanging back and sitting quietly and watching and thinking and then sharing their thoughts in other ways or being compassionate and supportive in other ways. And I think no matter what that answer is for each individual person, what that person really wants, digging down through the self-awareness to find out what that thing really is, I think that will serve us to do that. I have a hunch. It's just a hunch. I can't prove it. But I think that if every single one of us is willing to dig down through our own bullshit and figure out who we really are at our core and then be faithful to that thing, we might find out that a lot of problems solve themselves. And the only reason that seems to make so much sense to me is that it's been applying at a different level to my life, and I don't know how I got this happy, except the things I'm saying that seem to be describing what happened. And if it, just like I said before, if that's possible for me, all kinds of amazing things must be possible for other people. And so we all have to as individuals decide what that is and figure out for ourselves what that is. I think we can all find it.
Yeah. So everyone's homework for next time is to have done that.
You didn't tell me we were gonna prescribe homework.
Well, why not? Accountability,
yeah, sure,
man.
Why not? You can do the homework or not, whatever you like. Fine.
Yeah, that's fine. All right. I think that's as good a place to finish up as
sure.
as any. All right. Well, hold on. Let me turn this off and then we'll stop.
That was awesome. When do you want to do it again?
I told you.
On the schedule. When do we want to do it again?